I don't want no oil spoiling my shoreline. I like fish much better than crud. I like birds and things a-creeping and crawling. Won't trade no more oil for blood. The sun done give us all we need to make this country run. But that black demon oil's got us fussing and fighting, and I do believe it's time we was done. I don't want them nukes run by them kooks who think radioactivity is fun. No more three-headed frogs or kids with leukemia. Nuclear power ain't fit for a dog. The sun don't give us all we need to make this country run. But that nuclear power's got us fussing and fighting, and I do believe it's time we was done. No nukes!
Good morning, Toledo, and good afternoon, Columbus. And hello to everyone in Bowling Green. And a big hello to everyone listening on the internet, wherever or whenever you may be. My name is Shehbaz Khan, and I'm here with my open-minded co-host,
Rebecca Wood.
Welcome, Rebecca.
Thank you.
Together, Rebecca and I are going to bring you another informative hour of radio called For a Green Future. This show, For a Green Future, is a show where we talk about ecology and the environment. And we talk about them in the way that they affect you, your wealth, your health, and your happiness. And the wealth and health and happiness of your friends and family. And the health of the phytoplankton and the zooplankton. And the little fish and the big fish. And right up on to us, because like it or not, we are all stuck here on this brilliant pebble floating in space called Earth. We have yet another great show for you today. First, we are going to chat a little bit. Then, we have an excellent interview with Richard Steiner. He is a chairman of the board at PEER, Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility, PEER. And he will be talking with us about yet another horrible massacre of wildlife that happened this past spring in Alaska. Then, at the bottom of the hour, we'll hear from our wonderful patrons and sponsors. After that, we'll hear from Rebecca. Rebecca, what are we going to discuss today?
Okay, we're going to have bioswale versus rain gardens. Know the difference.
Oh.
And I do now. At least if I wrote it down, okay, I don't have to remember it.
But that is, again, as interesting as always.
Yes.
After that, we will get into the ecological news. And as our listeners know, that our last week's show about fathers, they may remember that we only managed to get two ecological news stories last week. So we have a lot of important ecological news to catch up with. We are also asking you to call in at 877-909-1007. We had two great callers last week who shared stories with us about experiences of their fathers and nature. You can feel free to call in with any questions or comments you might have on environmental topics or our program. Comments can also be texted to 419-973-5841. I repeat, 419-973-5841. Or they can be sent to joe@ jodemayerforagreenfuture.org. I repeat, joe@jodemayerforagreenfuture.org. To start off with the show, we thought we'd give a quick update about the Canadian wildfires. Since the whole mini Titanic thing drove all the discussion of them off the mainstream media, the number of active fires has continued to climb. On June 22nd, the number stood 416, out of which 213 were listed out of control. There have been more than 2,300 fires so far this year. About 6 million hectares have burned. That's 14 million acres, or an area roughly equal to the state of West Virginia. Even as the country continues to burn, Canada is pushing forward with plans for new natural gas and nuclear plants. Several communities around Canada have been evacuated. The mini Titanic story also drove another piece of news from the North Atlantic off the headlines. That is that the incredible heating of ocean surface temperatures that continues to cause scientists shock and dismay. It's hard to convey how much hotter and how dramatic current temperatures readings are compared to historic norms. Sea surface temperatures skyrocketed into never-before-seen levels back in April, and they stayed there ever since, almost 3 months of constant, continuous record temperatures. The one bright spot in all of this is that the idea that we are caught up in a positive feedback loop is rapidly being accepted as a consensus among scientists. It's the only thing that can explain incredibly rapid rise in temperatures. And I think Rebecca explained us how positive feedback loop works.
Did I? I don't remember this. I heard something about the deep water currents are slowing down too.
Yeah.
I forget where, but yeah, which is alarming.
Okay, so those of us in Northwest Ohio are experiencing some nice, cool, damp weather right now. So right now, it's hard for us to imagine how serious this situation is. Texans, however, are having no problem because they are in the middle of a tremendous heat wave. Over the next several days, most of the Texas is forecast to have record high temperatures. The entire state will be above 90 degrees. Most of it will be between 100 and 110. About a third of the state will be between 110 and 120. And the southern tip of Texas is forecast to have heat indexes over 120 degrees Fahrenheit. This is the third week of this heat wave, and records have been falling like dried leaves off a drought-killed tree. San Angelo hit a record high of 114. Del Rio was 115. Falcon Lake hit 117. And Rio Grande Village had 118. As we have said before, Northwest Ohio happens to be one of the best places to be on the continent in terms of global warming. With the continent protecting us from the overheating oceans and the Great Lakes lessening the shock of sudden temperature changes, we are sitting about as pretty as anyone on Earth. So life around here is continuing, and in fact, in many ways, we are thriving. It's mayfly season, as we like to note every year. This year, the mayflies seem to be making their way farther inland than usual. On June 23rd, the wall of cinema in Perrysburg was covered with thousands of mayflies. As usually happens, the swarms are big enough to show up on a weather radar. Ohio Edison has actually begun to turn streetlights off in some communities along Lake Erie to discourage the flies. Port Clinton, Marblehead, and Erie townships are all going dark, which is beneficial to many species, not just mayflies. So we are doing okay at the moment, but that doesn't reduce our responsibility to the rest of the world. One positive development we have noticed in recent weeks is a definite uptick in the number of electric vehicles on the road. Teslas still dominate, but Chevy Bolts and plug-in hybrid cars like the Chrysler Pacifica plug-in hybrid are showing up in greater numbers. Changing over to an electric vehicle is the single greatest thing the average American can do to lessen their carbon footprint.
My uncle came to visit me yesterday, and he has, I believe, a hybrid Corolla.
Wow.
So, you know, someday we have to get him and Joe together and have a debate about whose electric hybrid is better.
Better. Yeah, I think that will be a good discussion.
Okay.
Yeah. As we have reported before, the U.S. may have finally reached a tipping point when it comes to adoption of electric cars. That tipping point seems to be 5% based on the experience of Norway, which, as we reported a few weeks ago, now has 91% of new car sales, one or another form of electric vehicle. So basically 91% of their car sales is in some shape or form electric. The US passed 5.1% in 2022. So far in 2023, sales are more than 7.2%. Okay. This is finally the year to get the electric car or plug-in hybrid you have been thinking about. As we have reported, the tax credits are huge and can bring the cost down into the same price range as a regular internal combustion engine car. It's really encouraging to see that is finally happening, even here in the United States. Of course, there are also the idiots who are modifying their cars and trucks so that they burn more gas. They change out the exhaust system so that their cars roar like dinosaurs and belch out thick clouds of exhaust. They think they are making a statement, but the only statement they are making is they are idiots. They are giving more money to the oil companies. Then they have to. I mean, they are usually paying more money to the oil companies than an average user. And driving with a car that belches smoke actually causes respiratory diseases like asthma. It's easy to forget when big, obnoxious cars like that drive by that the vast majority of people do care about the environment and global warming. Most people are trying to buy the most fuel-efficient car they can afford. Of course, better mass transit, electric buses and trains, for example, is even better than electric cars. And not having to drive everywhere for everything is better still. In a truly green future, people will use bikes, walking and trains more than cars. Not because they are forced to by some authoritarian state, but because it's more pleasant to walk, ride or bike or take a train. It's better for you. You will live longer and be healthier. Once you start making a habit of walking or biking whenever you can, you really start to wonder why so many people insist on locking themselves into their own little metal boxes to get anywhere. Once everyone starts using mass transit, it will be made more comfortable and accessible. In major cities, you have plenty of bus stops and benches and comfortable places inside where you can wait to catch a bus or a train, unlike Toledo.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Yeah.
But let's get back to the idea that most people actually do care about the environment. The folks over at Yale Climate Connections put out an article on June 21st titled, and I quote, "Most Americans underestimate the popularity of policies to protect the climate." So most Americans underestimate the popularity of policies to protect the climate. For over a decade, polling has shown that two-thirds or more of Americans understand the seriousness of global warming. What's more, two-thirds also support big, bold plans to fight climate change, like the Green New Deal. carbon taxes or 100% renewable energy mandates. But when the researchers polled Americans about what they believed about other Americans, when the researchers polled Americans about what they believed other Americans thought about global warming, they had exactly the opposite numbers in their heads. At the same time, the vast majority of Americans believe in global warming and want to do something about it. They believe that they are in the minority. They believe that most Americans are global warming deniers. Yep. That's because the global warming deniers are louder and much more obnoxious. It's just like with cars. If you are sitting waiting for your electric bus on a nice comfortable bench and 100 quiet electric cars slip almost silently past you, you are not going to think about anything of it. But when one gigantic pickup truck with two huge exhaust pipes sticking up from the bed roars past you loudly, you have to put your fingers in your ears and you are left coughing and gasping from the smoke. You are going to remember that. That's what the pro-fossil fuel and pro-nuclear trolls count on. Every time there's an online story about global warming, the comment sections are filled with obnoxious trolls, hurling insults and global warming denial like a spoiled six-year-old throwing away birthday cake at everyone, having a tantrum because they were given the wrong Pokemon doll. Yeah, that's how they behave. So it's important for you to know that you are right. Global warming is real. We support you in your decision to buy an electric car or a plug-in hybrid. We are happy when we see you putting solar panels on your roof. In fact, the majority of Americans want almost everything that is essential for a green future. They want clean water, rivers you can drink from and swim and fish in. They want protections for old growth forests. They are fed up with the 1,000-year-old trees being grounded up for toilet paper. They support indigenous communities that are trying to stop pipelines from going through their lands. They want to see our wildlife preserved, not wiped out. They are even, believe it or not, willing to make some sacrifices to see these things happen. But as long as people believe they are in the minority, they believe making an individual sacrifice or change isn't going to help that much because the majority are still intent on using up the planet. It's very hard to get people to actually change their ways. People aren't willing to make sacrifices. They believe it will do no good. Well, this is your wake-up call. It turns out most everyone you know is also ready to make a change if they know it will do some good. Show them that it will. Start making the changes yourself, and you will be surprised at how that change will spread and more people will start adopting it. It happened in Norway. Just few years ago, electric car sales were below 5%. Now they are at 91%. Another change people want to see is an end to the centuries-old policies of the government wiping out wildlife. There is no reason, scientific or otherwise, for federal dollars to be used to kill predators and prey animals. Almost all animal species are in decline right now.
Because you can let the predators kill the prey animals, cut out the middleman.
Yes. And you know, I mean, most of the factors which we will be discussing, I mean, are human-caused factors.
Yes.
Like just you mentioned, overhunting, climate change, even habitat destruction. Most people don't want to see their tax dollars used to push animals even closer to extinction. Yet, that is exactly what is happening around the country. We have reported before about the federal APHIS program, where federal government directly kills millions of animals each year deemed as nuisance animals. Well, today's guest is going to tell us about another federal program. This program actually pays state governments. It is supposed to be used for wildlife protection, but in many states, it is used for exactly the opposite, wiping out the wildlife. This past spring, Alaska used these federal funds to slaughter a record number of predators. We will let our guest tell you more about it. Okay, Josh, let us see.
Hello and a warm welcome to For a Green Future. Could you please tell us your name and who you are with?
Hi, this is Rick Steiner. I'm a former professor from the University of Alaska here in Alaska, and I'm also the current chair of the board of directors for PEER, Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility.
So we have run stories from PEER before, but you are our first guest from that organization. Could you please give us a little background on PEER, who you are and what you do?
Sure. Yeah, it's a remarkable organization, actually. Their main focus is to both advocate environmental responsibility. They're a nationwide group, but also to advocate those public employees that advocate science-based environmental integrity through their institutions, but then get punished often for it. Some people get fired for speaking out. PEER protects environmental whistleblowers, essentially, within public organizations such as state governments, federal agencies, universities, and such. And it's a remarkable organization from that standpoint. They're mainly environmental attorneys, and so they have a number of tools that they use to protect public employees that advocate for the environment within the agencies.
So on June 14th, you folks put out a pretty alarming press release. And I quote the title. The title, I believe, was Feds Subsidizing Slaughter of Wild Predators, unquote. So what happened in Alaska this spring?
Yeah, we issued this press release earlier this month based on a number of things, but essentially what happened last month in Alaska, the state of Alaska has been conducting these lethal predator control programs for decades, killing wolves, brown bears, and black bears, ostensibly trying to increase moose and caribou and deer populations for hunters to then take. Often it doesn't work, but regardless, this spring, last month, the state of Alaska flew into an area with helicopters in southwest Alaska and killed, from helicopter shooting, 94 brown bears, including cubs, 5 black bears, and 5 wolves, just within a 2 to 3 week period, arguing that that would help the Mulchatna caribou herd, which has crashed in its population, to recover. It's certainly by far the largest kill of predators by state agents in such a short time in our state history, probably anywhere in the nation, possibly anywhere in the world. Alaska's lethal predator control program has been widely regarded as unscientific, unnecessary, ineffective, costly, unethical, inhumane, and it's incredibly controversial, and it often doesn't work. So we issued a press release. The odd thing about it, too, is most of the state wildlife agency's budget comes from the federal government, from the Department of Interior's Pittman-Robertson funding. It's a surcharge on ammunition and sporting equipment around the nation that then goes into this fund, and hundreds of millions of dollars are paid to state wildlife agencies every year to support, theoretically, wildlife restoration. But what it really comes down to is the states use this money just about for anything they choose, shuffling it around between different categories. And so this federal money is being used to support the state's lethal predator control program here, which we think is not just unethical, we think it's illegal. It certainly is wrong and should be suspended. So we're asking that the federal government suspend any further payments to the state of Alaska for wildlife restoration until there is adequate scientific oversight of the use of these funds and the state ends its predator control efforts.
You talk about these federal funds. So is there any watchdog agency at a federal level which kind of monitors the funds usage?
You would think there would be, and the problem, that's a great question, and that is the problem. There isn't. PIER has done some over the years trying to shine a spotlight on the state wildlife agencies around the nation that are misusing these funds. But technically, we submitted a rulemaking petition to the Department of Interior 2 years ago with a number like 30 or 35 different NGOs across the country. And it was forwarded through the Global Indigenous Council to the Secretary of Interior, proposing that the Department of Interior adopt a rule that would provide one public comment and public scrutiny on all these funds that go to state wildlife agencies from the federal government. And secondly, that there be adequate scientific oversight. And thirdly, that when the federal agency and its scientific oversight of the use of these funds by states determines that state wildlife management is not in line or supportive of federal wildlife management goals, that these funds be held in suspension until the states clean up their act. We have not even received a response from the Biden Department of Interior on that. So there needs to be oversight, absolutely.
So quickly to my next question, Mr. Richard, don't you think that the idea that you should eliminate predators in order to increase game animals get disapproven way back in the 1950s?
Yeah, I think science has been pretty clear on this. This used to be, a century ago, people thought, well, to make more deer and caribou and moose and sheep and things like that, we need to kill the predators. And that's the only thing that we do from a management standpoint. But all of these populations, these wild ungulate hoofed animal populations, are very dynamic. There's multiple causes of what increases their population and what decreases their population. Predation is only one of them. And often, mm-hmm. we know that predators often take the weak, the sick, the elderly, and sometimes the young, so that they can actually increase the vitality of the herd rather than decrease it. The other problem is we've seen that when you remove predators, sometimes a ungulate herd can get too large and overgraze a prey resource, a plant-based prey resource, and cause a catastrophic collapse of the population down the road. So if there is any benefit from predator control on an ungulate population, it's usually very short-lived, and almost and far more often there's more harm caused than good. So these things should be in our history books. They should not be a current practice in wildlife management, period. The Mulchetna caribou herd that the state of Alaska was trying to help has declined from about 200,000 caribou. It's just one of our many, many caribou herds in Alaska. And the Mulchetna herd has declined from about 200,000 in 1997 to only 12,000 now. Oh, but that's due to many factors: climate change and habitat problems, disease, a brucellosis problem, and overhunting. The state should have restricted hunting years ago to protect that herd, but they didn't. And now here we are. And so the only thing the way to cover their mismanagement is to go out there and kill every single bear and wolf within that calving aggregation of the herd last month, which is what they did. I don't think in world history there have been 94 brown bears, grizzly bears killed within a 2-week period by state agents, government agents anywhere. It's quite a historic disgrace for the state of Alaska, to be honest with you.
Mm-hmm. And I think out of the many factors you mentioned of the declining for the declining population, most of the factors are man-made factors rather than natural disasters. So this brings on to my next question, sir. How exactly does removing predators harm prey animal populations?
That's a good question. And I mean, the whole point of state governments and the federal government does this too, through a very arcane agency called Wildlife Services within the Department of Agriculture. They go around and eliminate predators and what they consider nuisance populations of animals all the time. But the argument is that it would assist ungulate populations, but it seldom does. And when it does, it's only short-lived. And on the other side of that equation, often, you're leaving sick and diseased and less fit animals in a population by removing the predators. And the other thing is that, again, the prey population, the caribou or moose or deer population, when you remove the predators, can expand beyond the carrying capacity of its habitat and then crash catastrophically and remain low for years. And that's something we've seen in many places. We've seen it here in Alaska. And plus the other issue with the Multchatna caribou herd that they were trying to help last month is that they've been doing wolf control out. The state has been killing wolves out there, all the wolves around that herd, for about 10 or 12 years. That has not helped the herd to recover. So you remove predators and new predators come in. These bears travel from 100 miles or more into this post-calving aggregation where the caribou are having their calves. And, every spring before the salmon start coming into the stream, that's what bears do. So this will not have any long-term positive impact on the herd. And it's just it's done politically. I think there's this deep-seated anger and hatred that some people still have for wolves and bears. And they want to be seen doing something. So they like flying around shooting them. And it's a barbaric, ancient sort of emotional mm-hmm. sentiment that has no place in modern wildlife management.
That's true. So usually we find a lack of game animals. The cause is overhunting by humans, not predators. So is that the situation in Alaska as well?
Yes, I believe that's the situation with this specific caribou herd. That has declined from 200,000 animals down to 12,000 in a 25-year period. But again, there are multiple factors that cause these hooved animal populations to go way up and way down. They're very dynamic. They respond to environmental cues. You can have a hard winter. You can have a winter in which you have, freeze-thaw things and then ice forming over their grazing habitat where they can't get food and there's starvation. That happens a lot here in Alaska, particularly with climate change. So humans are definitely the only controllable factor, and that's with global carbon emissions and hunting take, essentially. Again, they should have restricted hunting take of that caribou herd years ago. And they only did that about 2 or 3 years ago. So they were really late to the game, to the issue the state of Alaska was. So
what should be happening here? What changes are PIER asking for?
We're asking through our rulemaking petition to the Department of Interior submitted 2 years ago, with a number of NGOs throughout the United States submitted through the Global Indigenous Council, some good, strong Indigenous advocates, to have the Department of Interior adopt a rule so all federal funds that are paid annually to state wildlife agencies have to go through a public comment period. That is not the case now. Have to go through rigorous scientific review. And then thirdly, those funds be restricted from state wildlife agencies that conduct these lethal, large-scale lethal predator control efforts that we know are not scientifically rational or supported. And so that's what we've proposed to the Department of Interior. They mm-hmm. have yet to respond. But if people want to weigh in, they could contact their local U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service office or the Secretary's office in Washington, D.C. directly and say, support that rulemaking petition from September of 2021.
Geez, is there anything you would like to add?
Well, just that this antiquated predator control ideology is sort of driven by an irrational hatred and fear some people still hold for wolves and bears, trying to increase the availability of some of these ungulates for trophy hunters and things like that. And it's just antiquated. It's old fashioned. It has no place in modern wildlife management. And we need the federal goals are to establish naturally balanced wild ecosystems. Those are good. But then why are they paying all this money to state wildlife agencies that are then trying to manipulate wild mm-hmm. ecosystems to increase moose and caribou and deer populations for hunters to kill? So it makes no sense. And we need the Biden administration to step up to the plate and do its job here.
Please educate our listeners. How can people find out more about PIER?
I would say the website, which is just peer.org. And it's a wonderful organization. They get, they're mostly environmental attorneys, and they're involved in all sorts of issues, wildlife management, chemical pollution, scientific integrity, whale protection, all sorts of issues. So I would encourage people to look at the website there and get involved.
The website is peer.org, peer.org.
That's right.
Thank you, Mr. Richard. It was wonderful talking to you. It was a great experience. And I believe I was able to learn a lot of things about Alaska and what things are going on there in concern to the wildlife.
Wonderful. Yeah, great talking to you, Shivaz. And I hope your listeners learned something too. And this is a wonderful place, but we need public help from across the country because most of these lands here in Alaska are federal.
All right, my dear listeners, that was Richard Steiner. Thank you very much. We are very happy to be able to bring you that interview from our friends at PIER. But our only regret is that often we are the only news outlets, one of the news outlets probably that brings you this kind of vital information. We are only able to do that because of the support of our sponsors and patrons. Let's hear from our sponsors now.
For a Green Future is also brought to you by the Wood County Park District. The Wood County Park District is a natural resources conservation agency. They protect natural spaces, maintain quality green spaces, provide engaging programming, and they teach people to love and respect nature. They also restore wildlife habitats and lead people on outdoor adventures. Wood County Parks protects natural spaces in Wood County for all to enjoy from 8 a.m. to 30 minutes past sunset every day of the year. There are several ways to get a hold of them and find out what's happening. One is to call them at 419-353-1897. Another is to visit their website, www.wcparks.org. The website again is www.wcparks.org. They are also available on all social media, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, and many others. Just search for WC Parks. That's the Wood County Park District, and we're very grateful for their support.
All right, my dear listeners, this show, For a Green Future, is also brought to you by our patrons. These are forward-looking people who understand that information is vital to our democracy and the future. It is vital that we continue to give people that information, and we are grateful to our patrons who make that possible. These are people who have gone to patreon.com, that is patreon.com, patreon.com, and searched For a Green Future. Our show popped up and they signed up to have a small donation come out of their accounts and over to us. We thank our patrons because without them, we could not afford to keep doing this show. Okay, dear listeners, now it is the most interesting time part of our show, Rebecca's show. All right, Rebecca.
Alrighty, so yesterday, actually, I had some relatives from out of town, and we went and saw the Middle Grounds Metro Park, which is, I hadn't been there for a couple years. It's coming along nicely. It's more grown up. There's a lot more things there now. And but yeah, they have this plaque about how the whole thing is an elaborate bioswale, like the whole part of the park that where you're going in the entrance near the bridge. You know, it's right under the high-level bridge, what we call in Toledo. Mm-hmm. And so they have this system. They have like a pipes coming off the bridge, and then they go into sort of underground square channels that are you can see because they've got like a metal grid on the top. Mm-hmm. And then those feed into these long kind of ditches that are lined with different kinds of plants and stones and all kinds of things. And there's a system of a couple of ponds also leading, you know, that are connected, leading down to the river. And so this is apparently something known as a bioswale, which is defined according to, let's see, the PGH2O, which is something to do with Pittsburgh and water. I think it may be the Pittsburgh Water Company. According to the Pittsburgh Water Company, bioswale is a long channel or trench that has vegetation and soil, mulch, or stones to slow down rainwater and filter out pollution. So it can be like things like grasses, flowers, and shrubs, and it's supposed to filter out litter, motor oil, and excessive fertilizer from lawns or even maybe fields, as far as I know. Comes from the word swale, a low or hollow place that is often wet. And a rain garden is a different thing. It's similar in a lot of ways. It's a depressed area planted with vegetation to collect rainwater, filter pollutants, and soak water into the ground, and they're bowl-shaped.
Wow.
So mostly with a bioswale, it's like a channel, and it may eventually feed into a rain garden, I would think, possibly, or a river or some kind of waterway. Mm-hmm. So yeah, but with a rain garden, you're channeling it directly into the soil. So according to the National Association of City Transport's officials, one good thing that they do, they're designed for, is to deal with something called the first flush, which is the initial surface runoff in a rainstorm, which tends to be the most concentrated with pollutants, which makes sense. You know, it comes down and it washes a bunch of stuff out, and then, you know, the next part of it isn't so bad, hopefully. They can be integrated with medians, cul-de-sacs, and bulbouts, something called bulbouts. Mm-hmm. These are little curb extensions that occur usually at corners. Okay. So they kind of narrow the street a little. I guess it's it's a whole city planner thing.
Okay, like
slow down traffic.
Around the bends.
Yeah. They make pedestrians more visible, I guess. And yeah, you can sort of integrate that one. I did look up some words here, like I do sometimes. They can be composed of diverse native vegetation. You should consider species compatibility and also minimum irrigation requirements and potential for habitat creation when you're doing your bioswale. Sorry. And the purpose of the rocks is to dissipate the water's exit energy and velocity, so it's not washing stuff away, which okay. causing erosion, which is we know is bad.
From the Great Depression and whatnot. A bioswale needs to be on a slope of 4% or less. Mm-hmm. And to make it that, you have to use berms, dams, and weirs to create a step-down gradient.
Mm-hmm. So you don't want it just kind of, charging down there real fast.
So this reminds me of something what we called in India rainwater harvesting. So what basically we did in rainwater harvesting is collected all the rainwater which falls on the roof, on the rooftops,
Right.
And they have these huge pits dug up as to harvest the rainwater, to store the rainwater, and it can be later on used, So
It sounds very much similar to what I have seen back in India.
Well, it's not a real high-tech thing, you know. There's no wires, basically. You could do it all with, you know, by hand with stone and stuff if you wanted.
I think
probably people have been for a few millennia.
And I think that's a wonderful
way to conserve water.
Yeah.
Because believe it or not, I mean, you know, the fresh water or drinkable water in the on the entire planet is very less.
Yes.
Very less.
Yes.
Yeah. Any of the listeners out there, if they know how much percent of water, how much percentage of water is there on a planet which we can drink, let us know. All right. So that was an interesting story, Rebecca.
Yeah, nuts and bolts. You gotta know this stuff.
All right. So our listeners, I think it's time for our ecological news. Okay, here's the first story. As we told you last week about that more than 9,000 page budget bill that passed the Senate, we reported that happily that HB 434 was pulled out from that bill. We wanted to mention this week that unhappily SB 83, the bill that would force college professors to teach global warming denial, is still in the bill. The bill does many other evil things, such as cutting off food assistance to poor families and even cutting funding for school sports. Right now, it is in a conference committee which is trying to iron out the differences between the bills the Ohio Senate and House passed. Ohio Senate and House has passed. The word is that the legislature will probably miss the June 30th deadline for passing the budget. Next story is that New Yorkers fight Holtec's plan to dump radiation into the Hudson. In response to evil corporation Holtec's plan to dump a million gallons of radioactive water into the Hudson River, both the New York State Assembly and Senate have passed laws banning the dumping of any kind of radioactivity into state waters.
Activists have held rallies and on June 6th delivered petitions signed by over 400,000 New Yorkers demanding that Governor Kathy Hochul sign the bills and ban radioactive dumping in the state.
Good for them.
Yeah, that's really a great feat, I must say. They should keep on fighting it. Back in April, over 138 groups sent the governor a letter also urging her to stop the dump. Tritium is the main radioactive component, as we have reported in the past. It has a half-life of about 12 years. After 10 half-lives, radioactive elements decay away. So all Holtec would have to do to make the water safe is store it in tanks for 120 years. Dumping it into the river while it is still highly radioactive is not only ecologically disastrous, it's physically unnecessary. The water is sitting at the Indian Point nuclear plant, a nuke that has already been decommissioned. Holtec has similar plans to dump radioactive water into Lake Michigan at the Palisades nuclear plant and into Boston Harbor at the Pilgrim nuclear plant. If they are allowed to do this, dumping radiation into our waterways will become the standard method of disposing of these deadly pollutants. Let's hope Governor Hochul does the right thing. So we move on to our next story. Rooftop solars around the world. In a story on the PVmagazine.com website on June 13th, it was reported that worldwide 239 gigawatts of new solar was installed around the world in 2022. That's roughly the same amount of energy as 250 nuclear power plants. Rooftop solar accounted for half of that, and large-scale installation accounted for the other half. This is an annual growth rate of 45%. China led the way. 100 gigawatts of the 239 total were installed in China. That's 72% growth rate. In the US, however, solar installation actually dropped 7%, as Republican-controlled legislators at the state and local levels continue to ban solar and wind power. Or, as in Bowling Green, Ohio, additional fees and penalties to solar that make it uneconomical. Despite the drop, the US is still second in the world in solar installation, installing 22 gigawatts. India was the third with 17 gigawatts. Australia, South Korea, and Japan also saw drops in solar installation.
Not coincidentally, the political elites in those countries are always pushing for nuclear energy, pulling more resources and attention away from truly clean energy sources like wind and solar. Still, the momentum globally seems to be unstoppable. Italy and Spain posted growth rates of 127% and 105% respectively. In those countries, it was home rooftop installations that led the way. Many Europeans have come to see having solar panels on their roof as a valuable hedge against rising electricity prices. So, globally, it looks like 2023 will see even larger increase in solar installations, from 341 gigawatt in 2022 to 402 gigawatts in 2023. If the world can maintain this rate of acceleration of clean energy and falling nuclear and fossil fuel use, we will be able to meet clean energy goals and head off the worst global warming scenarios.
Moving on to the next story. Montana children sue to stop fossil fuels. The state of Montana has two clauses in its state constitution that are incredibly responsible from an environmental standpoint. The first says, all persons have a right to a clean and healthful environment. The second says that the state and each person shall maintain and improve a clean and healthful environment in Montana for present and future generations. Using these clauses, back in March of 2020, a group of 16 children sued the state of Montana, claiming that the state's policy of encouraging fossil fuels like coal and oil violates the state constitution. This week, the case has finally gone to trial. The case is named Held versus the State of Montana. A number of environmental law firms and organizations are supporting the young people, including our Children's Trust, the Western Environmental Law Center, and the McGarvey Law Firm. The trial is expected to go until June 23. It can be watched live by going on to the website youthvgov.org and follow those links there. Many of the young people who initially filed the suit are no longer children, but if they succeed, it will set a precedent in law that could help protect all future generations of Montana. Moving on to the next news. EPA sued over Agent Orange. In January of 2022, under the Biden administration, reapproved use of the chemical 2,4-D on farm fields. It had been banned in 2015 because the toxic effects were much worse than predicted. Chemical companies want to allow farmers to spray Agent Orange, a mixture of 2,4-D and glyphosate, on fields filled with plants that have been genetically modified to resist those chemicals. 2,4-D causes non-Hodgkin lymphoma. Please excuse me if I'm pronouncing it wrong. Non-Hodgkin lymphoma. According to the World Health Organization, glyphosate is also probably carcinogenic. The Center for Food Safety, Pesticide Action Network of North America, and Alliance Nicola de Companies. Oh, I think it's
Alliance?
Yeah. Alliance Nicola de Companies, INC.
Well, that's quite foreign.
Yeah. So, They have sued the EPA over its reapproval, pointing out that using Agent Orange on farm fields threatens wildlife, including monarch butterflies and many other endangered species. It kills almost every native plant species in North America. And I remember when you were, one of your friends, the roommate, she was sharing her story.
Yeah.
On the Father's Day about
we love Barbie's dad, but don't be like Barbie's dad. Don't use it around the house, your yard as a pesticide or anything. Just don't use it at all.
So is this the same Agent Orange?
Yes, it is the same Agent Orange. Yes.
My God. Yeah.
It wasn't. Nobody told him that it was in fact Agent Orange, and you could tell people if they're handling Agent Orange, please.
Yeah. See, I just want to say it is kind of a vicious cycle, you know, like how farmers using even more deadlier chemicals against weed species. That are becoming more and more resistant to those chemicals, you know. So what is happening is the collateral damage is
in the collapse of the entire ecosystems. That is the show for today, dear friends. I hope you enjoyed it. Thank you very much, Mr. Richard. And Rebecca, your last words.
Okay, in the words of the Thomas Dolby song, Wind Power, switch off the mind and let the heart decide what you were meant to be. Scatter the seed and furrow in our land, there is no enemy.
Yeah.
I don't know if that made sense or fit in with anything. I just like it.
All right, listeners. Have a nice evening. Bye-bye.
I don't want no oil, a spoil in my shoreline. I like fish much better than crud. I like birds and things a-creepin' and crawlin'. Won't trade no more oil for blood. The sun done give us all we need to make this country run. But that black demon oil's got us fussin' and fightin', and I do believe it's time we was done. I don't want them nukes run by them kooks who think radioactivity is fun. No more three-headed frogs or kids with leukemia. Nuclear power ain't fit for a dog. The sun don't give us all we need to make this country run. But that nuclear power's got us fussing and fighting, and I do believe it's time we was done. No nukes!